This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Wednesday Wars by Gary D. Schmidt, narrated by Joel Johnstone.
September. Of all the kids in the seventh grade at Camillo Junior High, there was one kid that Mrs. Baker hated with heat whiter than the sun. Me. And let me tell you, it wasn't for anything I'd done. If it had been Doug Swiatek that Mrs. Baker hated, it would have made sense. Doug Swiatek once made up a list of 410 ways to get a teacher to hate you. It began with, "Spray deodorant in all her desk drawers," and got worse as it went along. A whole lot worse. I think that things became illegal around number 167. You don't want to know what number 400 was, and you really don't want to know what number 410 was. But I'll tell you this much. They were the kinds of things that sent kids to juvenile detention homes in upstate New York, so far away that you never saw them again. Doug Swiatek tried number 6 on Mrs. Sidman last year. It was something about Wrigley gum and the teacher's water fountain, which was just outside the teacher's lounge, and the Polynesian fruit blend hair coloring that Mrs. Sidman used. It worked, and streams of juice the color of mangoes stained her face for the rest of the day, and the next day, and the next day, until I suppose those skin cells wore off. Doug Swiatek was suspended for 2 whole weeks. Just before he left, he said that next year he was going to try number 166 to see how much time that would get him. The day before Doug Swiatek came back, our principal reported during morning announcements that Mrs. Sidman had accepted voluntary reassignment to the main administrative office. We were all supposed to congratulate her on the new post. But it was hard to congratulate her because she almost never peeked out of the main administrative office. Even when she had to be the playground monitor during recess, she mostly kept away from us. If you did get close, she'd whip out a plastic rain hat and pull it on. It's hard to congratulate someone who's holding a plastic rain hat over her Polynesian fruit blend colored hair. See? That's the kind of stuff that gets teachers to hate you. But the thing was, I never did any of that stuff. Never. I even stayed as far away from Doug Swiatek as I could. So if he did decide to try number 166 on anyone, I wouldn't get blamed for standing nearby. But it didn't matter. Mrs. Baker hated me. She hated me a whole lot worse than Mrs. Sidman hated Doug Swiatek. I knew it on Monday, the first day of seventh grade, when she called the class roll, which told you not only who was in the class, but also where everyone lived. If your last name ended in Berg or Zog or Stein, you lived on the north side. If your last name ended in Ellie or Eni or O, you lived on the south side. Lee Avenue cut right between them. And if you walked out of Camillo Junior High and followed Lee Avenue across Main Street, past McLean's Drugstore, Goldman's Best Bakery, and the 5- and 10-cent store, through another block and past the free public library, and down one more block, you'd come to my house. Which, my father had figured out, was right smack in the middle of town. Not on the north side, not on the south side, just somewhere in between.
"It's the perfect house," he said.
But perfect or not, it was hard living in between. On Saturday morning, everyone north of us was at Temple Beth El. Late on Saturday afternoon, everyone south of us was at Mass at St. Adalbert's, which had gone modern and figured that it didn't need to wake parishioners up early. But on Sunday morning, early, my family was at St. Andrew Presbyterian Church listening to Pastor McClellan, who was old enough to have known Moses. This meant that out of the whole weekend, there was only Sunday afternoon left over for full baseball teams. This hadn't been too much of a disaster up until now. But last summer, Ben Cummings moved to Connecticut so his father could work in Groton, and Ian McAllister moved to Biloxi so his father could be a chaplain at the base there instead of the pastor at St. Andrew's, which is why we ended up with Pastor McClellan, who could have called Isaiah a personal friend, too. So, being a Presbyterian was now a disaster. Especially on Wednesday afternoons, when at 1:45 sharp, half of my class went to Hebrew school at Temple Beth El, and at 1:55, the other half went to catechism at St. Adalbert's. This left behind just the Presbyterians, of which there had been three, and now there was one. Me. I think Mrs. Baker suspected this when she came to my name on the class roll. Her voice got kind of crackly, like there was a secret code in the static underneath it. "Howling Hood Hood," she said. "Here?" I raised my hand. "Hood Hood." "Yes?" Mrs. Baker sat on the edge of her desk. This should have sent me some kind of message, since teachers aren't supposed to sit on the edge of their desks on the first day of classes. There's a rule about that. "Hood Hood," she said quietly. She thought for a moment. "Does your family attend Temple Beth El?" she said. I shook my head. "St. Adalbert's, then?" she asked this kind of hopefully. I shook my head again. "So on Wednesday afternoon you attend neither Hebrew school nor catechism?" I nodded. "You are here with me." "I guess," I said. Mrs. Baker looked hard at me. I think she rolled her eyes. "Since the mutilation of guess into an intransitive verb is a crime against the language, perhaps you might wish a full sentence to avoid prosecution. Something such as, 'I guess that Wednesday afternoons will be busy after all.'" That's when I knew that she hated me. This look came over her face like the sun had winked out and was not going to shine again until next June. And probably that's the same look that came over my face, since I felt the way you feel just before you throw up. Cold and sweaty at the same time, and your stomach's doing things that stomachs aren't supposed to do, and you're wishing, you're really wishing, that the ham and cheese and broccoli omelet that your mother made for you for the first day of school had been Cheerios like you really wanted, because they come up a whole lot easier, and not yellow. If Mrs. Baker was feeling like she was going to throw up too, she didn't show it. She looked down at the class roll. "Mai Ti Huang?" she called. She looked up to find Mai Ti's raised hand and nodded. But before she looked down, Mrs. Baker looked at me again, and this time her eyes really did roll. Then she looked down again at her list. "Daniel Hopfer," she called, and she looked up to find Danny's raised hand, and then she turned to look at me again. "Marilee Kowalski," she called. She found Marilee's hand and looked at me again. She did this every time she looked up to find somebody's hand. She was watching me because she hated my guts. I walked back to the perfect house slowly that afternoon. I could always tell when I got there without looking up because the sidewalk changed. Suddenly, all the cement squares were perfectly white, and none of them had a single crack. Not one. This was also true of the cement squares of the walkway leading up to the perfect house, which were bordered by perfectly matching azalea bushes all the same height, alternating between pink and white blossoms. The cement squares and azaleas stopped at the perfect stoop, three steps like every other stoop on the block, and then you're up to the two-story colonial, with two windows on each side and two dormers on the second floor. It was like every other house on the block, except neater, because my father had it painted perfectly white every other year, except for the fake aluminum shutters, which were black, and the aluminum screen door, which gleamed dully and never, ever squeaked when you opened it. Inside, I dropped my books on the stairs. "Mom!" I called. I thought about getting something to eat. A Twinkie, maybe. Then chocolate milk that had more chocolate than milk, and then another Twinkie. After all that sugar, I figured I'd be able to come up with something on how to live with Mrs. Baker for 9 months. Either that, or I wouldn't care anymore. "Mom!" I called again. I walked past the perfect living room, where no one ever sat because all the seat cushions were covered in stiff, clear plastic. You could walk in there and think that everything was for sale, it was so perfect. The carpet looked like it had never been walked on, which it almost hadn't. And the baby grand by the window looked like it had never been played, which it hadn't since none of us could. But if anyone had ever walked in and plinked a key or sniffed the artificial tropical flowers or straightened a tie in the gleaming mirror, they sure would have been impressed at the perfect life of an architect from Hood Hood and Associates. My mother was in the kitchen, fanning air out the open window and putting out a cigarette, because I wasn't supposed to know that she smoked, and if I did know, I wasn't supposed to say anything, and I really wasn't supposed to tell my father. And that's when it came to me, even before the Twinkie. I needed to have an ally in the war against Mrs. Baker.
How was your first day? My mother said.
Mom, I said, Mrs. Baker hates my guts.
Mrs. Baker doesn't hate your guts, she stopped fanning and closed the window.
Yes, she does.
Mrs. Baker hardly knows you.
Mom, it's not like you have to know someone well to hate their guts. You don't sit around and have a long conversation and then decide whether or not to hate their guts. You just do. And she does.
I'm sure that Mrs. Baker is a fine person and she certainly does not hate your guts.
How do parents get to where they can say things like this? There must be some gene that switches on at the birth of the firstborn child and suddenly stuff like that starts to come out of their mouths. It's like they haven't figured out that the language you're using is English and they should be able to understand what you're saying. Instead, you pull a string on them and a bad record plays. I guess they can't help it. Right after supper, I went to the den to look for a new ally. Dad, Mrs. Baker hates my guts.
Can you see that the television is on and that I'm watching Walter Cronkite? He said.
We listened to Walter Cronkite report on the new casualty figures from Vietnam, and how the air war was being widened, and how two new brigades of the 101st Airborne Division were being sent over, until CBS finally threw in a commercial. Dad, Mrs. Baker hates my guts.
What did you do?
I didn't do anything. She just hates my guts.
People don't just hate your guts unless you do something to them. So, what did you do?
Nothing.
This is Betty Baker, right?
I guess.
The Betty Baker who belongs to the Baker family?
See what I mean about that gene thing? They miss the entire point of what you're saying.
I guess she belongs to the Baker family, I said.
The Baker family that owns the Baker Sporting Emporium?
Dad, she hates my guts.
The Baker Sporting Emporium, which is about to choose an architect for its new building, and which is considering Hood and Associates among its top three choices?
Dad?
So, Holly, what did you do that might make Mrs. Baker hate your guts, which will make other Baker family members hate the name of Hood, which will lead the Baker Sporting Emporium to choose another architect, which will kill the deal for Hood and Associates, which will drive us into bankruptcy, which will encourage several lending institutions around the state to send representatives to our front stoop holding papers that have lots of legal words on them, none of them good, and which will mean that there will be no Hood and Associates for you to take over when I'm ready to retire?
Even though there wasn't much left of the ham and cheese and broccoli omelet, it started to want to come up again. I guess things aren't so bad, I said.
Keep them that way, he said.
This wasn't exactly what I had hoped for in an ally. There was only my sister left. To ask your big sister to be your ally is like asking Nova Scotia to go into battle with you. But I knocked on her door anyway, loudly since the monkeys were playing. She pulled it open and stood there, her hands on her hips. Her lipstick was the color of a new fire engine. Mrs. Baker hates my guts, I told her.
So do I, she said.
I could use some help with this.
Ask Mom.
She says that Mrs. Baker doesn't hate my guts.
Ask Dad.
Silence. If you call it silence when the monkeys are playing.
Oh, she said. It might hurt a business deal, right?
So he won't help the son who is going to inherit Hood and Associates. What am I supposed to do?
If I were you, I'd head to California, she said.
Try again.
She leaned against her door. Mrs. Baker hates your guts, right?
I nodded.
Then, Holling, you might try getting some.
And she closed her door. That night I read Treasure Island again. And I don't want to brag, but I've read Treasure Island 4 times, and Kidnapped twice, and The Black Arrow twice. I even read Ivanhoe halfway through before I gave up, since I started The Call of the Wild and it was a whole lot better. I skipped to the part where Jim Hawkins is stealing the Hispaniola, and he's up on the mast, and Israel Hands is climbing toward him, clutching a dagger. Even so, Jim's in pretty good shape, since he's got two pistols against a single dagger, and Israel Hands seems about to give in.
"I'll have to strike which comes hard," he says.
I suppose he hates Jim's guts right at that moment, and Jim smiles since he knows he's got him.
That's guts.
But then Israel Hands throws the dagger, and it's just dumb luck that saves Jim. And I didn't want to count on just dumb luck. Mrs. Baker eyed me all day on Tuesday, looking like she wanted something awful to happen. Sort of like what Israel Hands wanted to happen to Jim Hawkins. It started first thing in the morning, when I caught her watching me come out of the coat room and walk toward my desk. By the way, if you're wondering why a seventh grade classroom had a coat room, it isn't because we weren't old enough to have lockers. It's because Camillo Junior High used to be Camillo Elementary, until the town built a new Camillo Elementary and attached it to the old Camillo Elementary by the kitchen hallway, and then made the old Camillo Elementary into the new Camillo Junior High. So all the rooms on the third floor where the seventh grade was had coat rooms. That's where we put our stuff, even though it was 1967 already and we should have had hall lockers like every other seventh grade in the civilized world. So I caught Mrs. Baker watching me come out of the coat room and walk toward my desk. She leaned forward as if she was looking for something in her desk. It was creepy. But just before I sat down, I figured it out. She'd booby-trapped my desk, like Captain Flint would have. It all came to me in a sort of vision, the kind of thing that Pastor McClellan sometimes talked about, how God sends a message to you just before some disaster, and if you listen, you stay alive. But if you don't, you don't. I looked at my desk. I didn't see any trip wires, so probably there weren't any explosives. I checked the screws. They were all still in, so it wouldn't fall flat when I sat down. Maybe there was something inside. Something terrible inside. Something really awful inside. Something left over from the eighth grade biology labs last spring. I looked at Mrs. Baker again. She had looked away, a half smile on her lips. Really. Talk about guilt. So I asked Merrill Lee Kowalski, who has been in love with me since she first laid eyes on me in the third grade. I'm just saying what she told me. I asked her to open my desk first.
How come?
She said. Sometimes even true love can be suspicious.
Just because.
Just because isn't much of a reason.
Just because there might be a surprise.
For who?
For you.
For me?
For you.
She lifted the desktop. She looked under English for you and me, mathematics for you and me, and geography for you and me.
I don't see anything, she said.
I looked inside. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I was wrong, said Merrill Lee, and dropped the desktop. Loudly.
Oh, she said. Sorry. I was supposed to wait until you put your fingers there.
Love and hate in seventh grade are not far apart, let me tell you. At lunchtime, I was afraid to go out for recess, since I figured that Mrs. Baker had probably recruited an eighth grader to do something awful to me. There was Doug Swiatek's brother, for one, who was already shaving and had been to three police stations in two states and who once spent a night in jail. No one knew what for, but I thought it might be for something in the number 390s or maybe even number 410 itself. Doug Swiatek said that if his father hadn't bribed the judge, his brother would have been on death row. We all believed him.
Why don't you go out for lunch, recess? Said Mrs. Baker to me. Everyone else is gone.
I held up English for you and me. I thought I'd read in here, I said.
Go out for recess, she said, criminal intent gleaming in her eyes.
I'm comfortable here.
Mr. Hoodhood, she said.
She stood up and crossed her arms, and I realized I was alone in the room with no witnesses and no mast to climb to get away. I went out for recess.
I kept a perimeter of about 10 feet or so around me and stayed in Mrs. Sidman's line of sight. I almost asked for her rain hat. You never know what might come in handy when something awful is about to happen to you. Then, as if the dread day of doom and disaster had come to Camillo Junior High, I heard,
"Hey, Hood Hood."
It was Doug Swiatek's brother. He entered my perimeter. I took 3 steps closer to Mrs. Sidman. She moved away and held her rain hat firmly.
"Hood Hood, you play soccer? We need another guy."
Doug Swiatek's brother was moving toward me. The hair on his chest leaped over the neck of his t-shirt. "Go ahead," called the helpful Mrs. Sidman from a distance. "If you don't play, someone will have to sit out." If I don't play, I'll live another day, I thought.
"Hood Hood,"
said Doug Swiatek's brother.
"You coming or not?"
What could I do? It was like walking into my own destiny.
"You're on that side,"
he pointed. I already knew that.
"You're a back," he said.
I knew that too. Destiny has a way of letting you know these things.
"I'm a forward."
I could have said it for him.
"That means you have to try to stop me."
I nodded.
"Think you can?"
I suppose I could stop you, I thought. I suppose I could stop you with the Bradley tank, armor 2 inches thick, 3 mounted machine guns, and a grenade launcher. Then I suppose I could stop you. "I can try," I said.
"You can try."
Doug Swiatek's brother laughed, and I bet that if I had looked over my shoulder, I would have seen Mrs. Baker peering out her third floor classroom window, and she would have been laughing too. But the thing about soccer is that you can run around a whole lot and never, ever touch the ball. And if you do have to touch the ball, you can kick it away before anyone comes near you. That's what I figured on doing. Doug Swiatek's brother wouldn't even come near me, and I would foil Mrs. Baker's nefarious plan. But Doug Swiatek's brother had clearly received instructions. The first time he got the ball, he looked around and then came right at me. He wasn't like a normal forward, who everyone knows is supposed to avoid the defense. He just came right at me, and there was a growl that rose out of him like he was some great clod of living earth that hadn't evolved out of the Mesozoic era, howling and roaring and slobbering and coming to crush me. I expect that the watching Mrs. Baker was almost giddy at the thought. "Get in front of him!" screamed Danny Hupfer, who was our goalie. "In front of him!" His voice was cracking, probably because he was imagining the propulsion of a soccer ball as it left Doug Swiatek's brother's foot and hurtled toward the goal and wondering what it might do to his chest. I didn't move. Danny screamed again. I think he screamed, "In front!" But I'm not sure. I don't think he was using language at all. Imagine a sound with a whole lot of high vowels, and I think you'd have it. But it didn't make any difference what he screamed, because of course I wasn't going to get in front. There was no way in the world I was going to get in front. If Doug Swiatek's brother scored, he scored. It was just a game, after all. I stepped toward the sideline, away from the goal, and Doug Swiatek's brother veered toward me. I ran back a bit and stepped even closer to the sideline, and he veered toward me again. So as Danny Hupfer screamed vowels and Doug Swiatek's brother growled mesozoically, I felt my life come down to this one hard point like it had been a funnel channeling everything I had ever done to this one moment, when it would all end. And that was when I remembered Jim Hawkins, climbing up the side of the Hispaniola to steal her, tearing down the Jolly Roger flag, sitting in the cross trees and holding Israel hands back. Guts. So I glanced up at Mrs. Baker's window. She wasn't there, probably so she wouldn't be accused of being an accomplice. And then I ran toward the goal, turned, and stood. I waited for Doug Swiatek's brother to come. It was probably kind of noble to see. I stood my ground. And I stood my ground, and I stood my ground, until the howling and the roaring and the slobbering were about on top of me. Then I closed my eyes. Nothing says you have to look at your destiny. And stepped out of the way. Almost. I left my right foot behind, and Doug Swiatek's hairy brother tripped over it. Everything suddenly increased in volume. The howling, and the roaring, and the slobbering, the whistling of Doug Swiatek's brother's airborne body hurtling toward the goal, the screams of Danny Hupfer, my own hollering as I clutched my crushed foot. Then there came an iron thunk against the goalpost, which bent at a sudden angle around Doug Swiatek's brother's head. And everything was quiet. I opened my eyes again. Doug Swiatek's brother was standing and sort of wobbling. Mrs. Sidman was running over, though properly speaking, what she did wasn't really running. It was more a panicky shuffle. She probably saw negligent playground monitor headlines in her future. When she got to him, Doug Swiatek's brother was still wobbling, and he looked at her with his eyes kind of crossed.
"Are you all right?"
Mrs. Sidman asked and held onto his arm. He nodded once, then threw up on her. He had eaten a liverwurst and egg sandwich for lunch. No one ever wants to see a liverwurst and egg sandwich twice. And Mrs. Sidman's rain hat did not help at all. That was the end of the soccer game. Except that Danny Hupfer, a very relieved Danny Hupfer, ran up to thump me on the back. He sure did take him out.
I didn't mean to take him out.
Sure, did you see him fly?
Like a missile.
I didn't mean to take him out, I hollered.
I never saw anyone get taken out like that before.
Doug Swiatek ran over.
You took out my brother.
I didn't mean to take out your brother.
Everyone says you took out my brother. I've been wanting to do that since I was out of the womb.
It was like a missile, said Danny. I limped back into school, trying not to look at an unhappy Mrs. Sidman, who was holding the wobbling Doug Swiatek's brother at the same time that she was using her rain hat to do not very much. Liverwurst is like that. Merrill Lee was waiting for me at the door.
You took out Doug Swiatek's brother? She asked.
I didn't mean to take him out.
Then how did he end up flying through the air?
I tripped him.
You tripped him?
Yes, I tripped him.
On purpose?
Sort of.
Isn't that cheating? He's 3 times bigger than I am.
So that means you can cheat and make him look like an idiot?
I didn't try to make him look like an idiot.
Oh, and you didn't try to make me look like an idiot opening your desk for some dumb surprise that wasn't even there?
What's that got to do with it?
Everything, said Merrill Lee and stomped away. There are times when she makes me feel as stupid as asphalt.
Everything. What's that supposed to mean?
Mrs. Baker's face was pinched when we came back into the class, the disappointment of a failed assassination plot. Her face stayed pinched most of the afternoon and got even pinchier when the PA announced that Doug Swiatek's brother was fine, that he would be back in school after 10 days of observation, and that there was a need for a playground monitor for the rest of the week. Mrs. Baker looked at me. She hated my guts. We spent the afternoon with English for You and Me, learning how to diagram sentences, as if there were some reason why anyone in the Western Hemisphere needed to know how to do this. One by one, Mrs. Baker called us to the blackboard to try our hand at it. Here's the sentence she gave to Merrill Lee. The brook flows down the pretty mountain. Here's the sentence she gave to Danny Hupfer. He kicked the round ball into the goal. Here's the sentence she gave to My T. The girl walked home. This was so short because it used about a third of My T's English vocabulary since she'd only gotten here from Vietnam during the summer. Here's the sentence she gave to Doug Swiatek. I read a book. There was a different reason why his sentence was so short. Never mind that it was a flat-out lie on Doug Swiatek's part. Here's the sentence she gave me. For it so falls out that what we have we prize not to the worthwhiles we enjoy it, but being lacked and lost, why, Then we rack the value. Then we find the virtue that possession would not show us while it was ours. No native speaker of the English language could diagram this sentence. The guy who wrote it couldn't diagram this sentence. I stood at the blackboard as hopeless as a seventh-grade kid could be. "Mr. Hood Hood," said Mrs. Baker. I started to sweat. If Robert Louis Stevenson had written a sentence like that in Treasure Island, no one would have ever read the book, I thought. "If you had been listening to my instructions, you should have been able to do this," said Mrs. Baker, which is sort of like saying that if you've ever flicked on a light switch, you should be able to build an atomic reactor. "Start with what we have," she said and smiled at me through her pinched face, and I saw in her eyes what would have been in Long John Silver's eyes if he had ever gotten hold of Captain Flint's treasure. But the game wasn't over yet. The PA crackled and screeched like a parrot. It called my name. It said I was to come to the principal's office. Escape. I put the chalk down and turned to Mrs. Baker with a song of victory on my lips. But I saw that there was a song of victory on her lips already.
"Immediately," said the PA.
I suddenly knew. It was the police. Mrs. Baker had reported me. It had to be the police. They had come to drag me to the station for taking out Doug Swiatek's brother, and I knew that my father would never bribe the judge. He'd just look at me and say,
"What did you do?"
as I headed off to death row. "Immediately," Mrs. Baker said. It was a long walk down to the principal's office. It is always a long walk down to the principal's office. And in those first days of school, your sneakers squeak on the waxed floors like you're torturing them, and everyone looks up as you walk by their classroom, and they all know you're going to see Mr. Guareschi in the principal's office, and they're all glad it's you and not them. Which it was. I had to wait outside his door. That was to make me nervous. Mr. Guareschi's long ambition had been to become dictator of a small country. Danny Hupfer said that he had been waiting for the CIA to get rid of Fidel Castro and then send him down to Cuba, which Mr. Guareschi would then rename Guareschiland. Merrill Lee said that he was probably holding out for something in Eastern Europe. Maybe he was. But while he waited for his promotion, he kept the job of principal at Camillo Junior High and tested out his dictator of a small country techniques on us. He stayed sitting behind his desk in a chair a lot higher than mine when I was finally called in.
"Halling Hood," he said.
His voice was high-pitched and a little bit shrill, like he had spent a lot of time standing on balconies screaming speeches through bad PA systems at the multitudes down below who feared him. "Hood Hood," I said.
"It says Halling Hood on this form I'm holding."
"It says Halling Hood Hood on my birth certificate." Mr. Guareschi smiled his principal smile.
"Let's not get off on the wrong foot here, Halling. Forms are how we organize this school, and forms are never wrong, are they?"
That's one of those dictator of a small country techniques at work, in case you missed it. "Halling Hood," I said.
"Thank you," said Mr. Guareschi.
He looked down at his form again.
"But Halling," said Mr. Guareschi, "we do have a problem here. This form says that you passed sixth grade mathematics, though with a decidedly below average grade."
"Yes," I said. "Of course I passed sixth grade mathematics. Even Doug Swiatek had passed sixth grade mathematics, and he had grades that were really decidedly below average." Mr. Guareschi picked up a piece of paper from his desk.
"But I have received a memo from Mrs. Baker wondering whether you would profit by retaking that course."
"Retake sixth grade math?"
"Perhaps she is not convinced that your skills are sufficiently developed to begin seventh grade mathematics."
"But..."
"Do not interrupt, Halling Hood. Mrs. Baker suggests that on Wednesday afternoons, starting at 1:45, you might sit in on Mrs. Harknett's class for their math lesson."
"Somewhere? Somewhere. There's got to be a place where a seventh-grade kid can go and leave the Mrs. Baker's and Mr. Guareschi's and Camillo Junior High's so far behind him that he can't even remember them."
Maybe on board the Hispaniola, flying before the wind, mooring by a tropical island with green palms crowding the mountains and bright tropical flowers, real ones, poking out between them. Or maybe California, which, if I ever get there, you can bet that I would find the virtue that possession would show us. But Mr. Guareschi returned to his form and read it over again. He shook his head. "According to this record," he said, still reading, "you did pass sixth grade mathematics." I nodded. I held my breath. Maybe I could dare to believe that even a dictator of a small country might have a moment of unintended kindness. Mrs. Baker does have a legitimate concern, it would seem. But a passing grade is a passing grade. I didn't say anything. I didn't want to jinx it. "You'd better stay where you are for now," he said. I nodded again. "But," Mr. Guareschi leaned toward me, "I'll double-check your permanent record, Hollinghood. Be prepared for a change, should one be necessary." In case you missed it again, that's another one of the dictator of a small country techniques. Keep you always off balance. Mr. Guareschi scribbled over Mrs. Baker's memo. He folded it, then took out an envelope from his desk. Looking at me the whole time, he placed the memo in the envelope, licked the flap, and sealed it. He wrote, "Mrs. Baker" on the outside, then he handed it to me. "Return this to her," he said. "The envelope had better be sealed when she receives it. I will make a point of inquiring about it." So I took the envelope, sealed, and carried it back to Mrs. Baker, sealed. She unsealed it as I sat back down in my seat. She read what Mr. Guareschi had written and slowly placed the letter in the top drawer of her desk. Then she looked up at me. "Regrettable." She said all four syllables very slowly. She could probably diagram each one if she wanted to. I watched her carefully for the rest of the day, but nothing ever gave away her murderous intentions. She kept her face as still as Mount Rushmore, even when Doug Swiatek's new pen broke and spread bright blue ink all over his desk, or when the Rand McNally map of the world fell off its hangers as she pulled it down, or when Mr. Guareschi reported during afternoon announcements that Lieutenant Tybalt Baker would soon be deployed to Vietnam with the 101st Airborne Division, and we should all wish him, together with Mrs. Baker, well. Her face never changed once. That's how it is with people who are plotting something awful. October. The Wednesdays of September passed in a cloudy haze of chalk dust. At 1:45, the bus arrived from Temple Beth El to spring half of my class. At 1:55, the bus arrived from St. Adalbert's to spring the other half. Even my T, who had to go to catechism since it was the Catholic Relief Agency that had brought her over from Vietnam, and I guess they figured that she owed them, even though she wasn't Catholic. Then Mrs. Baker and I sat, alone, facing each other. The classroom clock clicked off the minutes. She was probably considering what she could legally do to remind me how regrettable it was that my family was Presbyterian. "There's no point teaching you something new," she said. "You'd just hear it a second time tomorrow." So, that first Wednesday, I washed all the chalkboards. Then I straightened the Thorndike dictionaries. Then I washed all the chalkboards again, since they were streaky. Then I went outside and pounded the erasers against the brick wall of Camillo Junior High until the white chalk dust spread up and around me, settling in my hair and in my eyes and up my nose and down my throat, so that I figured I was probably going to end up with some sort of lung disease that would kill me before the end of the school year. All because I happened to be Presbyterian. The second Wednesday of September, and the third, and the fourth, and Wednesdays on into October were pretty much the same. I got good at the chalkboards, so Mrs. Baker added putting up her bulletin boards with microscopic pins and leveling tools and sweeping down the cobwebs from the asbestos tiles on the ceiling and
wiping the grime of sweaty hands off the lower half of the windows, then pushing them all up so that, as Mrs. Baker said, fresh air could circulate into the classroom, which it really needed, since once air reached the coat room, it landed on all the stuff from all the lunches that had been chucked into the corners because they were too vile to eat even when they were fresh. Lunches like liverwurst sandwiches. So after I got good at the windows, Mrs. Baker got me cleaning out the coat room. But what I didn't clean out was the stash that Doug Swiatek was hiding to prepare for number 166. So far, there was a box of tapioca pudding, a bag of marshmallows that had been smashed into a sticky pulp, a half dozen ragged feathers, a bottle of red ink, and a plastic bag with something awful in it. Probably something dead. He had it all in a small box from the AMP, stuffed on the shelf above the coats. I didn't touch any of it. And do you think I complained about this? Do you think I complained about picking up old lunches that had fungus growing on them and sweeping asbestos tiles and straightening Thorndike dictionaries? No, I didn't. Not once. Not even when I looked out the clean lower windows as the afternoon light of autumn changed to mellow and full yellows, and the air turned so sweet and cool that you wanted to drink it, and as people began to burn leaves on the sides of the streets, and the lovely smoke came into the back of your nose and told you it was autumn, and what were you doing smelling chalk dust and old liverwurst sandwiches instead? And why didn't I complain? Because after the first week in October, the Baker's Sporting Emporium narrowed its architect choices down to two, Hood and Associates and Kowalski and Associates. And so every single night, after supper but before Walter Cronkite began reporting, my father said to me,
"So, Holling, everything all right with Mrs. Baker?"
And I answered, "Just well."
"Keep it that way," he'd say.
So I didn't complain. Still, you would have thought that since all this was happening because I was a Presbyterian, God would have seen to it that the Yankees would have played in the World Series to pay me back for my persecution. But were they? Of course not. The world isn't fair that way. The Boston Red Sox were playing instead. And let me tell you, everyone knows that the Boston Red Sox are never going to win another World Series. Never. Not even if they have three Carl Yastrzemskis, which they don't. Doug Swiatek's brother was still not back in school, and Doug Swiatek told us why. The 10 days of observation had been pure delight for him, but when no one had found any behavior beyond his usual weirdness, he realized that he would be coming back to school again pretty soon. So the evening before he was to return, when he came to his classroom with Mrs. Swiatek to meet with his teacher, Doug Swiatek's brother walked up to the chalkboard and pounded the erasers against his head. Since Mr. Ludema didn't have someone like me around to pound them against the brick walls every Wednesday afternoon, Doug Swiatek's brother's hair turned white after about 4 poundings. Then he took 2 long pieces of chalk, stuck them into his mouth like fangs, and went howling and roaring and slobbering out into the hallway. The school was mostly deserted, so it really was just dumb luck that Mrs. Sidman, who had decided to leave her new post in the main administrative office, had come into school that particular evening to clean out the last of her personal effects. I think her screams echoed up and down the halls of Camillo Junior High until dawn. That bought Doug Swiatek's brother another 4 weeks of medical observation, and it was pretty clear from Mrs. Baker's glares the next morning that, somehow, she thought this was all my fault, which it wasn't. I didn't have a thing to do with it. But when someone hates your guts, truth, justice, and the American way don't mean all that much. On Wednesday, when we all stood up to go to Mr. Petrelli's geography class, Mrs. Baker stopped glaring. In fact, as we walked out with geography for you and me in our hands, she started to smile at me. Then I got worried. She looked like those evil geniuses who suddenly figure out a plan to conquer the world and can already imagine Earth's population quivering in their grasp. It was all I could do not to sprint out of Mrs. Baker's classroom, even though we weren't supposed to run in the halls, to the safe world of junior high geography. Mr. Petrelli believed that no class was worth anything without a study question data sheet. He dittoed these off like a major publisher. His hands were always blue from the ink, mostly because he hauled the dittos out from the machine while they were still wet from the alcohol, the smell of which gave the room a tang.
"Fill these out in pairs," he said. "You have 43 minutes.
43 minutes. Teachers don't reckon time the way normal people do. When Mara Lee came over to be my study partner, I was still wondering why Mrs. Baker had smiled. "Are you all right?" Mara Lee asked.
"Just swell."
"You're holding your pen upside down."
"Thanks for pointing that out, Detective Kowalski."
"You're very welcome. Do you think you can figure out the answers while I write them down on the sheet?"
"Why don't you figure out the answers while I write them down on the sheet?"
"Because I know how to write. What's the first state?"
"Delaware."
"Do you think Mrs. Baker looks like an evil genius?" "Not unless you're paranoid. What's the second state?"
"I'm not paranoid. Pennsylvania. Mrs. Baker hates my guts."
"Mrs. Baker doesn't hate your guts, and you are too paranoid. What's the third state?"
"Well, thank you for your vote of confidence. New York."
Mara Lee looked over at geography for you and me. "New York wasn't the third state. It was New Jersey, not New York."
"How do you know that?"
"Everybody knows that," she said.
"Oh, out beyond Mr. Petrelli's not-so-clean lower windows, it was one of those perfect blue autumn days. When the sun is warm and the grass is still green and the leaves are red and tipped with yellow. A few white clouds drifted high, teased along by a breeze as gentle as a breath."
"What's the fourth state?" said Mara Lee.
That's pretty much how it went for Mara Lee and me until recess, which had become a whole lot safer since Mrs. Baker's failed assassination plot. I figured that most of her would-be assassins had seen what had happened to Doug Swiatek's brother and were worried I might take them out too. So when we left Mr. Petrelli and went back to Mrs. Baker's classroom, I believed I could actually run out into the perfect October day and hope to come back alive. But then I found out why Mrs. Baker had been smiling. "Mr. Hood Hood," she called from her desk as the school clock clicked to noon. "I have a quick job for you. Everyone else, enjoy your recess." I looked at Mara Lee.
"See?"
I whispered.
"You are paranoid,"
she said and abandoned me. "Mr. Hood Hood," said Mrs. Baker. "There are some pastries that Mrs. Biggio has spent the morning baking for me that need to be brought up to this room. Would you go down to the kitchen and bring them here? And do not start any rumors. These are not for the class. They are for the wives of Vietnam soldiers gathering at St. Adalbert's this afternoon. Not for anyone else."
"Is that all?" I said.
"Don't look so suspicious," she said. "Suspicion is an unbecoming passion." I took my unbecoming passion and left to find Mrs. Biggio. This didn't seem like it would take too long, even though the seventh grade classrooms were on the third floor and the kitchen was on the first floor at the very end of the hallway, probably so that the wind could blow the fumes away. Sometimes that worked. And sometimes it didn't. When it didn't, the halls filled up with the scent of hamburger and pepper surprise. A scent that lingered like the smell of a dead animal caught underneath the floorboards. I think that Mrs. Biggio couldn't smell the scents, either because she wore a cotton mask over her face all the time, or because she had worked in the kitchen of Camillo Junior High for so long that she could no longer smell. But I didn't have a mask, and I could smell, so when I reached the kitchen, I got ready to take a deep breath before I walked in. But then I realized I didn't need to. There were no fumes. There was only the delicious, extravagant, warm, tasty scent of buttery baking crust and of vanilla cream and of powdered sugar still drifting in the heated air and stretched out on the long tables far from whatever surprise was being fed to Camillo Junior High for lunch that day were a dozen trays of cream puffs. Brown, light, perfect cream puffs.
"Mrs. Baker sends you,"
said Mrs. Biggio. I nodded.
"You can start with that one,"
she said, pointing. I thought, shouldn't Mrs. Biggio be grateful for my willingness to help? Wouldn't any human being with a beating heart hand me one of the brown, light, perfect cream puffs? Was that so unlikely? Yes, it was unlikely.
Now would be a good time to start, said Mrs. Biggio. And don't drop any.
I won't drop any, I thought, and you're very welcome. I picked up a tray in each hand.
One tray at a time, said Mrs. Biggio.
I looked at her. That will take me 12 trips to the third floor, I said.
So, Mr. Samowitz is teaching you some arithmetic after all. Don't drop any.
It took me the rest of lunch recess to carry the trays, one at a time, up to the classroom. Mrs. Baker smiled sweetly as I brought each one in. Place them on the shelf by the windows. The cool air will keep them from getting soggy. I thought of my father and the future of Hood Hood and Associates. I did not complain. Even when Mrs. Baker asked me to open the windows a little wider, and I had to move all the trays one at a time so that I could reach over the shelf and jerk all the windows open a little wider, I did not complain.
Thank you,
said Mrs. Baker, as the school clock clicked to 12:30 and the classroom began to fill and Danny Hupfer came to punch me on the shoulder because he thought the cream puffs might be for us, which they weren't. He figured that out when Mrs. Baker told us to take our Mathematics for You and Me books, line up by the door, and then head to Mr. Samowitz's class. Let me tell you, it is hard to care much about set theory when there are 12 trays of brown, light, perfect cream puffs cooling deliciously on a shelf back in your own classroom. 12 sets of cream puffs divided by 23 kids plus Mrs. Baker meant half a set of cream puffs for every person in that room. And don't think we weren't all figuring out the same equation. And don't think we weren't all worrying that Mr. Samowitz's homeroom class, who had walked past us with English for You and Me in their hands, was trying to get those same hands on our cream puffs. But they didn't. And when we came back in after set theory, the cream puffs were still there, cooling in the circulating air coming in beneath the clean lower windows, but Mrs. Baker acted like the cream puffs weren't there at all. And I suppose that in the end, it didn't really matter that they were there. They may as well have been over there with the wives of Vietnam soldiers at St. Adalbert's already for all the chance we had of getting one. When 1:45 came, half the class left, and Danny Hupfer whispered,
"If she gives you a cream puff after we leave, I'm going to kill you."
Which was not something that someone headed off to prepare for his bar mitzvah should be thinking. When 1:55 came and the other half of the class left, Mara Lee whispered,
"If she gives you one after we leave, I'm going to do number 408 to you."
I didn't remember what number 408 was, but it was probably pretty close to what Danny Hupfer had promised. Even my T looked at me with narrowed eyes and said,
"I know your home,"
which sounded pretty ominous. But I knew I was safe. It was just as likely that President Lyndon B. Johnson himself would walk into the classroom as Mrs. Baker would give me a cream puff. Actually, though, someone did come to the door after everyone had left. It wasn't President Johnson. It was a fifth grader from Camillo Elementary. He was carrying a box.
"There you are, Charles," said Mrs. Baker.
"Did you get them all?"
"I think so."
"From Mr. Petrelli's class and Mr. Samowitz?" Charles nodded. "And did you remember Mrs. Harknett downstairs?"
"Yes."
"And Mr. Ludema?"
"I got them all,"
Charles said. "Thank you. You may put them here on the desk." Charles put the box on Mrs. Baker's desk. He looked once at me, kind of sadly, I thought, then left, brushing his hands off. Chalk dust fell from them.
"Mr. Hood Hood," said Mrs. Baker, "recent events have led the junior high school teachers to conclude that we need to be keeping our chalkboard erasers much cleaner. So I asked Charles to gather them from the classrooms and bring them here each Wednesday." She gestured toward the box on her desk. "Would you take care of them, please?" If there ever was a time to complain, this was it. I walked over and looked into the box. There must have been 30 erasers in there, white with 6 weeks' worth of chalk. This was really the time to complain. But I thought of the future of Hood Hood and Associates. I picked up the box of erasers. "I'll be in the ditto room," said Mrs. Baker.
Just swell, I thought. But then Mrs. Baker said something that made the world spin backward. If we both finish in time, you may have one of the cream puffs. I think I must have gone white. You needn't look so shocked, she said. But I was shocked. She had offered the hope of a cream puff. A brown, light, perfect cream puff. It was as if Mrs. Baker had suddenly become not Mrs. Baker. It was like I had had another vision, only this one was real. So before the vision could fade, I carried the box of erasers down the hall, down two flights of steps and outside. The day was still a perfect blue October day, as if it had been waiting for me since I'd missed it at lunch recess. It smelled of baseball, and the last cut of grass, and leaves drying out, but still holding on. And for a while, I could smell all of it. But the cloud of white chalk that comes out of 30 erasers is pretty impressive, let me tell you. I pounded and pounded them against the wall, and the chalk dust that didn't get into my lungs flew and twisted with the breeze that curled against the first-floor classrooms, coating all the windows. The teachers had learned to close them on Wednesday afternoons now. A cream puff. At the end of a long school day, brown, light, and perfect, and no one